Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
Ceasefire extinguished. Benjamin Netanyahu calls the latest Hamas demands delusional, but a veteran negotiator tells us a ceasefire and a two-state solution are the only ways to keep Israelis and Palestinians safe.
Parental responsibility. A Michigan mother is found guilty of involuntary manslaughter for a school shooting committed by her teenage son. The father of one of his victims tells us why he feels that is a step forward.
Hunger so deep it is deadly. The medical charity MSF says 13 children are dying every day at a camp for displaced people in Sudan's North Darfur region.
The end of the roads. Four isolated First Nations in northeastern Manitoba declare a state of emergency when unusually warm weather closes the winter roads and leaves the communities cut off.
You've got plum tomatoes and you've got the plummest tomato. The creator of the purple tomato explains why they are the first genetically modified food crop to be marketed directly to home gardeners and why she thinks it might make GMO skeptics shift their thinking.
And breaches of etiquette. The punishment for a British police officer really hits below the belt. He was found to have committed gross misconduct and demoted for selling a pair of his police pants for really cheap. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that would never be caught with its pants marked down. There is no solution besides total victory. Those were the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's words today, his answer to a Hamas ceasefire proposal, which made demands for a complete withdrawal from Gaza by the Israeli military and an offer to release some hostages in exchange for Palestinians in Israeli prisons over the course of several months. Gershon Baskin helped negotiate an exchange between Israel and Hamas in 2011. He's now the Middle East director of the International Communities Organization, a human rights advocacy group. We reached him in Jerusalem.
Gershon, we last spoke to you near the end of October after the first hostages were released by Hamas. Today, we're hearing Benjamin Netanyahu say the only solution is absolute victory, calling the counterproposal for the ceasefire deal from Hamas, quote, delusional. But U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is saying it creates space for a deal to be reached. What do you hear when you hear all of those words? Are we actually closer to a deal now than we were before?
No, I think we're not. I think that Netanyahu closed the door on the possibility of genuine negotiations, although the Americans are pushing hard to keep their foot in the door and keeping it open. There is a Hamas delegation heading to Cairo tomorrow to meet with the Central Intelligence in Egypt to see if they can find some way of making a deal. There is a small possibility if Hamas would be willing to separate the first phase of the ceasefire that they have proposed from the second and third phases, which Israel rejects because essentially it leaves Hamas in power in Gaza with Israel withdrawing its forces from the Gaza Strip. And that's unacceptable to Israel. But if Hamas would be willing to have a 45-day ceasefire, during which time hostages, civilian hostages, would be released in exchange for a reasonable number of Palestinian prisoners, then a deal could be made.
Over the last few days, there have been murmurs of proposals, counterproposals, possibility of a ceasefire deal. We've seen these movements. Were you feeling hopeful at all during those conversations?
You know, I speak to families of hostages almost every day, and I have to be hopeful for them. This is such a tragic situation for those families and for the whole country who feel betrayed by the government of what happened on October 7th when there was no one there to defend the citizens of Israel as Hamas invaded and committed those atrocities. So hope is the only thing that we have to keep going on day by day. Israel is a traumatized society, just as Palestine is today. And for Israel, this is the biggest trauma since the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. We have not yet left October 7th. We're still there. We're witnessing it every day in the television, in the newspapers, in the stories of the hostages, of the families, of the people who were killed. We're really stuck.
What message then should the families take from Mr. Netanyahu's words today?
They should be upping their protest and making a lot more noise. It is the Israeli government who has got to decide that the hostages have to come first. The war can wait. They can finish the war after the hostages are back, if that's what they want to do, to completely annihilate the Hamas leadership. That can be done at another time, but first the hostages have to come home. We know that about a fifth of them have already been killed. The numbers I hear are even higher than that, and the government is not talking about that, but it's believed that maybe even 50 of the 136 hostages are no longer alive, and every day they're at risk.
We heard those reports earlier this week. Have you received any information that leads you to believe it's more than just reporting?
That's what I've heard from different people in the Israeli official government and military. It only becomes official when they notify families that their loved ones are no longer alive, when they have two sources of information, intelligence information, video footage, information that they've gathered from prisoners that they've taken out of Gaza, that they will make a determination that the person is no longer alive. But the official number now, I think, is 31 of the 136 who have been reported to their families that they are no longer alive.
What do you think would actually force Benjamin Netanyahu's hand here?
I'm not sure that we can force his hand. Netanyahu is also concerned that once the war is over or there's a prolonged ceasefire, that he's going to have his day of reckoning with the people of Israel. There's going to be a demand for a national commission of inquiry headed by a Supreme Court judge to investigate who's responsible for what happened on October 7th and everything that led to it. Netanyahu is the only person in the higher upper echelons of the Israeli government military who refuses to take any responsibility. There are signs being put up around the country. You're the head, you're responsible. And Netanyahu refuses to take that responsibility, but the people of Israel will hold him responsible. And he's aware of that. So he has a mixed interest. He believes, as he said tonight, that they will defeat Hamas, that they will kill the Hamas leaders, and then the hostages will be freed. I think that's a big, big gamble, because if they do meet the Hamas leaders somewhere in the bunkers and tunnels of Gaza, they're probably surrounded by hostages who are going to get hit in the crossfire. And there's no guarantee that the people who are holding other hostages will release them. If their leaders are killed, they may just execute the hostages as well. It's a very dangerous game that Netanyahu is playing.
You've been in these kinds of negotiations before. We talked about this in our last conversation back in October. You've also written an op-ed today saying that deterrence hasn't worked when you're talking about Hamas, that this will only, as others have told us in interviews as well, that this, in your view, in their view, will breed more fighters.
It will. Hamas, who base their ideology on a theology of death, on a theology which teaches people that they need to be martyrs for Palestine and for Jerusalem and for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. What we need to do to defeat Hamas is to make Palestine real for Palestinians. And that requires the important nations of the world, the OEC countries, including Canada, to recognize the state of Palestine now. We've had 30 years of countries all around the world talking about a two-state solution while only recognizing one. Israel has been granted a veto on Palestinian statehood, and that can't exist anymore. We have to tell Palestinians that they need to stop dying for Palestine and they need to start living for Palestine. But Palestine has to be real for them. And that means that countries like the United States and Canada and the big countries of Europe need to recognize Palestine and grant Palestine membership in the United Nations. That's the first step toward making Palestine real and to defeating Hamas. And the only viable solution has to be a two-state solution where both people have the same right to the same rights, that we both have the right to self-determination. Palestinians will not have dignity and freedom if Israel doesn't have security, and Israel won't have security if the Palestinians don't have freedom and dignity. There's a balance here that needs to be met, and we need the help of the world to do it.
Gershon, thank you very much for your time once again.
Thank you.
Gershon Baskin is the Middle East director of the International Communities Organization. We reached him in Jerusalem. In Cape Breton, a local state of emergency was declared because of severe winter weather. In a handful of provinces over, the opposite is true. Yesterday, the chiefs of four isolated First Nations in northeastern Manitoba declared a state of emergency due to unusually warm weather. The winter roads the communities rely on to bring in essential supplies like fuel have not been able to open yet, and supplies are running out. Charles Knott is the chief of Garden Hill First Nation. We reached him in Winnipeg.
Chief Knott, how much fuel does your community have left right now?
What I was told yesterday was we only got about a week's left.
And when that all runs out, what will that mean for people there?
Well, that's going to be... We need our fuel for our school buses and our water trucks, sewer trucks, you know. We need fuel in the community, and Winter Road hasn't opened yet in our section.
Yeah.
And we haven't gotten any trucks in yet as of this year, and it's very late in the year already.
Yeah. What other supplies do you need? If those trucks were moving as they would normally, what would they be bringing?
Well, lots from housing materials to fuel, essential needs, dry goods and stuff that the community needs to last till next winter season. Yeah. This is our lifeline. Winter Roads is our lifeline. And it only opens like 2 months every year. You know, that's when we have to truck in our goods.
Yeah.
And now this year has been hectic. You know, warm weather, climate changes.
I want to ask you about all of those things. But just for our listeners and anyone who hasn't seen this road before, can you describe the condition it is in right now?
Well, this year... you know, when you construct a winter road, you need snow. As you can imagine, there's a lot of creek crossings that we go through to build the winter roads. And we need snow to make snow bridges, you know. And this year we haven't had much snow. And that makes it difficult to construct a winter road this year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been raining for the past 2 days in Island Lake region. It's been a struggle this year. It's very different from previous years. Every year it's getting to be difficult mm-hmm. to construct the winter roads.
When you speak to elders and your own experiences, as you've been saying, this is different.
Yeah.
How rare is it to see, you know, when have you seen rain like this in February before?
Well, for my lifetime, I haven't seen any rain. For me, it's the first time I've seen this kind of weather, you know, middle of February. That's when you expect the cold weather to hit, but now it's raining in the middle of February. It's unreal. Yeah.
What kinds of things do you need because, you know, you say this, it's changing, the climate is changing, you're feeling the impacts first in many ways. So what needs to be done to make that connection?
In our region, there's a high cost of living already. Affecting the community. And if we have to fly in our goods and that, you know, it's going to double the cost of living. It's already high enough. And if we have to fly in our stuff, so I don't know. We have no choice but to do that. But on top of that, we don't have the funds to do that. A long-term solution would be to construct an all-weather road in our region. You know, there's 18,000 people plus in the region right now. It would be beneficial for all the communities if we were to have an all-weather road constructed.
Has there been opposition to that? Why hasn't that happened before?
When NDP was in power a couple of years ago, there was a East Side Road Authority trying to get the roads in there. And when conservatives got in, they scrapped that East Side Road Authority.
Are there plans to revive that plan?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I hope they do, since we have NDP mm-hmm. And here now in Manitoba, I hope they revive something. You know, something has to be done.
What's your sense of what's going to happen over the next few days? Do you think the road is going to open?
Well, you know, we had declared a state of emergency yesterday. We can't sit idly by and wait because the window is getting smaller every day. That's all I could say. The weather is not cooperating. Still, we have this weather. It is raining on and off there, and the snow is melting. You know, it doesn't look promising, but I'm still hopeful.
As you watch the weather situation, the state of emergency, as you mentioned, what will that allow you to do? What will that trigger now?
I don't know. We're hoping to get something like for my community. Like I say, we only have a week's worth of fuel. You know, we're going to be needing fuel for our school buses and our water delivery trucks and our sewage trucks. You know, we depend on those things. Our elders depend on those things. Because we have about 80% that need water deliveries within the community. So, yeah, we really going to be needing our trucks to come in if we run out. Especially the school buses, you know. I don't want to close the school down because of no fuel and that, you know. But what do we have other? I don't know. It's very concerning to me. I'm very worried.
Yeah.
I'm very worried what's going to happen. That's why I guess we're calling on a state of emergency, you know, and something needs to be done.
Chief Knott, yeah. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Take care.
Bye.
Charles Knott is the chief of Garden Hill First Nation. He's in Winnipeg. It is the first of its kind, a deep purple tomato. But the color isn't the only thing that's new about it. It's also the first genetically modified food crop to be sold directly to home gardeners in the United States. The seeds went on sale to the general public for the first time this past weekend. Kathy Martin is the plant biologist who created the purple tomatoes. We reached her in Norwich, England.
Kathy, the seeds have been out in the world, up for sale for a few days now. What's the response been?
It's been amazing. I think we've got 4,500 orders already.
Is that what you expected?
No, I really didn't expect that at all. It's just great. And I think people are curious. Yeah. Maybe it's going to be a novelty, but, you know, just a boom and bust. But I really hope people like them.
They're approved for sale in the U.S. Canadian home gardeners might be wondering if they can get them as well.
Not yet. So, in fact, the approval for sales came from USDA through the Secure Rule, and we have to do the same thing in Canada. So, and we are working on it, but one step at a time. But desperately want Canadians to be able to grow them too.
Noted. Thank you. You know, you mentioned the word novelty, and certainly they're very beautiful to look at, especially if you love the color purple. But tomatoes are already kind of lovely and pretty powerful and healthy as they are. So why do this?
It was done as part of an academic exercise to try and increase the amount of antioxidants in fruit, basically. But yeah. We used tomato as a model.
The goal, though, to make them healthier, it sounds like.
Yes. Yes, and we were able to show with some animal experiments that mice that were prone to cancer lived about 30% longer if they were eating a diet enriched with the purple tomatoes compared to red ones. So I think there's something in it.
What do they taste like?
They taste like tomatoes. But what we've done is that since we got the approval from USDA, mm-hmm. we've done some breeding so to make them taste better, because when you do something in the lab, it tends to be with a model variety. Yeah. And so we outcross them to heirloom varieties, which tend to taste really good. So we wanted to offer something that tasted good and looked good.
You know, when people hear genetically modified, GMO, these are these are dirty words, phrases in people's minds now. Don't they have a right to be concerned? Should they be concerned about what
of
you're doing
course.
Here?
And if people are that concerned, then they can choose not to eat them. We're only offering them to people to see if they like them. And I personally don't think that there's anything dirty about what we've done. We're not working for a big multinational or anything like that. And we very much wanted to do something for consumers rather than for big business.
There is a lot of skepticism, and a Pew study in 2020 suggested that most Americans perceive them as worse for their health than a food that has no genetic modification. So was part of this project as well to try to make people more open to GMOs?
I mean, I wouldn't have said that it was absolutely an academic exercise that when we first developed them, but we developed them 15 years ago. I mean, we published on it 15 years ago. So since then, it has been perhaps an exercise in trying to show that you can do good things that are focused on consumers. I mean, I think the evidence that genetic modification itself is in any way dangerous or might impact negatively your health is absolutely not there. And I haven't seen any evidence that that's the case.
You made a distinction just a moment ago, talking about the scale of production and talking about, you know, larger corporations, larger companies doing this. Is that the distinction you want to underline for listeners here?
Yeah, I'm very enthusiastic about the idea of getting it out to home growers because I like to grow things in my garden and grow novelties, and I know that they're beautiful and they taste good. So it's not something I don't want to create a war or anything like that. I just think that we'd very much like to be doing this, you know, local cultivation and through local vendors in the future.
Do you worry, though, when there's a good idea that catches on sometimes, as you'll know, that it will go from smaller scale to very, very big?
I'm an academic. I have my day job, and this has been something that's been bubbling along. So yeah. I don't worry about that, and I don't worry about copycats either. So it's been so hard to get it deregulated and approved, and I'd love for it to be available in Canada. Yeah. I think there's some interest in South America and perhaps in Australia. And, of course, I would like them to be available in the UK because the greatest irony is that they were produced in the UK and we can't buy them here and grow them here.
Are you doing any more tomato work? Any other surprising colors we may expect?
Well, we have another tomato which is enriched in resveratrol, and that's a compound that you can get in your diet but only from drinking red wine, quite good red wines, or eating peanuts. And so we have a new tomato that has the anthocyanins and resveratrol in it, and it has a slightly different color, so we call it bronze. And I'd quite like to bring that one to the market too. But
bronze,
it takes a long time. And we've shown that that's good for inflammatory bowel disease.
Mm-hmm. It's going to make a pretty beautiful plate, bronze and purple.
Yes, I think
tomatoes.
So. I have some pictures of multicolored tomatoes in salad.
Kathy, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise.
Cheerio.
Kathy Martin is a plant biologist and the creator of the purple tomato. We reached her in Norwich, England.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
In November 2021, Jennifer and James Crumbly bought their 15-year-old son, Ethan, a gun. His mother took him to a shooting range to test it out. Then his parents left it in their home where their son could access it. Just days later, Ethan Crumbly used that gun to carry out the deadliest school shooting in Michigan history. Now, more than 2 years later, a jury has found Jennifer Crumbly guilty of involuntary manslaughter. It's the first time a parent has been held directly responsible for a school shooting committed by their child in the United States. Craig Schilling's son, Justin, was one of the four students killed at Oxford High School. We reached him in Oxford, Michigan.
Craig, you woke up today knowing Jennifer Crumbly was convicted of involuntary manslaughter. Did that knowledge make it easier to sleep through the night?
Last night I slept through it very well because it was just an exhausting day. Mm-hmm. Waking up this morning, knowing that she was convicted, it's definitely a load off my chest, a little bit off my mind. But knowing that there's still a lot more to do, it just kind of shifts my focus to the next thing. And it's definitely like a cycle.
Hearing those words yesterday, the guilty verdict, after all that you've been through and all of these months, how did that sit with you to hear it out loud?
Well, there was a pretty broad range of emotions. The tensions were high. When it finally came, everybody had a deep exhale, and you could hear it, and I can almost feel the energy in the room change, and it was a moment for sure. There's no, happiness or about anything in this situation, so I can't really say that, I'm happy for it. I'm just glad that, the outcome went the way that we were mm-hmm. hoping for.
Ethan Crumbly was sentenced to life in prison in a previous proceeding without parole. That was last year. You mentioned the next step. What is the next step legally?
It's the next trial. It starts in a few weeks for the father. I'm still kind of we're digesting what happened, and I'm sure that based on what happened, it will affect the next trial.
Over the course of this trial, you heard the prosecution say Jennifer Crumbly failed to properly secure the gun, that she and her husband, who, as we've said, is also going to stand trial, failed to adequately address her son's mental health issues. Was there something you heard that did sort of stop you?
Yes. The remarks that she made on her on the stand there, her testimony about the fact that she wouldn't have done anything different.
She said she wouldn't have done anything differently.
Right. That was the most shocking part of the trial for me, just hearing her say that. And I found it was really disrespectful to the families and, the victims.
You mentioned that moment where you and the other parents exhaled. What are they telling you about this decision now?
Everybody has that same similar feelings. And we've been talking more in recent weeks regarding some of the other action that we're working on.
What is that action?
We have, contacted our governor's office, and we're working with the state to try and implement a systemic change in how things are run, how schools are operating. Mm-hmm. It's a movement, and there's a lot of people in the community that are behind us, and I can imagine there's a lot of people everywhere that, want to see the right types of programs in their own school districts and, from their own state. Mm-hmm. Just to try and, thwart this kind of stuff from happening again. It's unfortunate that, society is the way it is, and it's all just sad. It's something that doesn't really need to be.
It is very sad. You said after the verdict that it feels like a milestone, this decision. Do you think it sends a message to parents across the United States as well?
Absolutely. I feel that it does get a message across, and you know the culpability of this type of thing is more broader than just the person who does it. And I'm thankful to have the law enforcement and the investigators and the prosecutors that you know worked tirelessly on the case to make sure that it was dealt with right and that all the evidence was presented in an appropriate way, and you know they did a great job. And yeah, it was a milestone for sure.
I wanted to talk as well about Justin, your son, if you wouldn't mind. What would you want our listeners to know about him?
Oh, geez, he was a great kid. He loved hunting, fishing, outdoors. He was a very outdoorsy kind of a guy. Mm-hmm. He loved to travel, experience different places, and meet new people. I mean, I would think that was one of his favorite things to do, was to like bring somebody new into his life and just interact and let them know that they're welcome, and a very dynamic individual with a great personality.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, real bright future.
Craig, I'm very sorry for your loss. I'm very appreciative of your time. I hope you do get some moments to yourself. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Neil. Appreciate you.
That was Craig Schilling, whose son was killed in the mass shooting at Oxford High School in 2021. He's in Oxford, Michigan. The sound of students at Calgary's Western Canada High School participating in one of the school walkouts that took place across Alberta today. As you can hear, they're calling for trans rights and protesting a series of new rules tabled by the provincial government. Together, the policies will reduce access to puberty blockers, require parental permission for name or pronoun changes in schools, bar trans women and girls from participating in a variety of sports, and prohibit gender reassignment surgeries under the age of 17, which, it should be noted, are extraordinarily rare. According to Western Canada students Yomati Acapo and Charlie Anderson, all of that harms kids. And they see the province's whole approach as hypocritical, coming from a premier whose legal first name isn't actually Danielle.
Today we are protesting against Marlena Smith's new legislation against trans kids. She's taking away rights from people who haven't done anything wrong. She's taking away rights from people. It's just a violation of human rights. It's absolutely disgusting that that's something that she could do to like thousands of trans kids out there. I don't think she understands how she's affecting these kids, how she's affecting their mental health. It's just disgusting to me. I'm just like hearing a whole lot of fear, a whole lot of kids are scared about like what this means. Like, their parents will find out that they use a different name at school. They can't use their preferred pronouns. I know some kids who wanted to start some gender-affirming like treatment, and now they're worried that they can't do it. This isn't right. Like, we should be able to respect every human being, whether they're trans, whether they're any type of LGBTQ. It's just disgusting that Marlena Smith would deny them just basic human respect.
And sorry, do you think this protest will make a difference?
I think that in protesting, we're fighting for like making a difference. Like, I think that this will make a difference because we're at least saying something instead of keeping quiet.
So tell us why you came out today.
I just think it's really important that kids have a safe space to go, because I know that I have a few friends that school is their safe place, and it's always been their safe place. They're just feeling scared, mostly, about
the trans youth!
Trans youth!
Protect trans youth! Protect trans youth! Protect trans youth! Protect
just being part of the LGBTQ plus community, it makes me feel like better to know that there are people out there that are willing to stand up for people that maybe don't have the voice or don't have the courage to speak up for themselves.
Protect trans youth! 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 Protect trans youth!
Western Canada High School students Yomadia Capo and Charlie Anderson at a school walkout in protest of Alberta's new transgender policies today. They were speaking with the CBC's Aaron Collins. Médecins Sans Frontières is warning that an absolutely catastrophic situation is unfolding in a camp for displaced people in Sudan's North Darfur region. The NGO carried out a malnutrition and mortality survey at Zamzam camp recently. That survey estimates that at least one child is dying every 2 hours in the camp and says malnutrition has reached emergency levels. It's calling for a mass mobilization of the international community, saying that UN agencies and international NGOs have maintained only a limited presence in North Darfur since the war broke out in April. Emmanuel Berbin is a doctor with MSF who just returned from a month in North Darfur. He was in the region's capital, Al-Fashir, and the camp nearby. We reached him in Paris.
Emmanuel, in the month that you were there, I know you saw many children and their families and heard from them, but there's one patient in particular I know who stays with you. Can you tell us about him?
So Adam is 9 months old. He was 5 kg last week, and he was accompanied by a mother. Actually, he was in the nutritional program already for a few months, but he missed a couple of appointments. And when I discussed with him, I asked why did he miss his appointment and we have to readmit him and restart from zero. And her mother explained me that her husband was killed actually recently, and that's why she had to miss his appointment. They left south of North Darfur 6 months ago due to the violence, and she arrived in the camp. She complained mostly about the water that she has to pay for, and for bad quality water, and for the food that she has to buy, and she has no money. So she relies completely on the solidarity of a couple of local people mm-hmm. who try to support her, but they are themselves really poor with many kids.
They have to pay for water in the refugee camp.
Yeah, so it's actually for now. Bon, we need a deeper assessment, but it seems that the main system in place, some businessmen own a whale or a water trucking system, like mm-hmm. they pay for the water to come in the camp, and these businessmen sell it to the population.
The statistics our listeners heard in the introduction to our conversation, a child every 2 hours dying, 13, your organization estimates, every day. It is horrifying and staggering to hear. If you don't get the help that you're asking for now, how will that situation change?
The problem, and that's why we really want to deploy and to request to deploy the full humanitarian response as it should be, is that it's going to deteriorate for sure. January is a period of the year where the malnutrition is the lowest because the harvest has been done. So there is supposed to be some stock of food available at the household level. We are out of specific epidemic except malaria. And I mean, the survey we did in January, we covered the period of November, December, and there were a lot of malaria. And there are still some malaria. But what I mean that there is no measles yet. There is no significant diarrheal epidemic like shigellosis, salmonellosis, hepatitis B, and this can affect a lot the mortality. Measles especially usually starts in March in this situation. A lot of vaccinations were not done last year. And in addition to that, the small stocks of food that are available at the household level will diminish. The food commodities prices will continue to grow up and skyrocket. And it will continue growing and deteriorate malnutrition rates and mortality to reach probably a very maximum around June and July in a more than alarming situation. Yeah.
It will get worse. What is already
bad
will get much worse.
Yeah.
At the clinic that MSF is running in the Zamzam camp, you know, where are people coming from? How far do they have to travel just to be able to see you and the other doctors?
We have many patients, with stories of patients who come from Tawila, for example, which is a city of more than 50 kilometers from Zamzam camp, who come during the day, wait overnight in order to get the opportunity to get some nutritional products and medications for free the day after. This is really, unusual, to see people making such distances for probably little supply or little. We are not talking about, coming back with 50 kg of cereals for your whole family. This is really due to the complete collapse of the health system, especially about the primary and secondary and tertiary health system. But there is just nothing else to go to. So we are in El Fasher locality, the only major international actor which developed the functional activities for primary and secondary healthcare.
The United Nations is asking for $4.1 billion US for these humanitarian efforts in Sudan and for the neighboring countries where people have had to flee to. UN aid chief Martin Griffiths spoke about this morning.
The figures speak for themselves. There's 25 million people in Sudan who need assistance. Half of them are children. That's an astonishing figure. 14 million children are in need of humanitarian assistance. We must not forget Sudan. That's the simple message that I have to say today.
Do you think people in the international community have forgotten Sudan?
My personal impression is a yes. This current crisis is clearly one of the largest displacement of population and humanitarian crisis, and people just don't know, and the means don't come, resources don't come, agencies are not present. We have to remember that the last huge crisis in Darfur was the genocide in 2003 and 2004. It was a massive humanitarian response from the UN agencies and also from MSF and many international actors. But the thing is that even in 2003 and 2004, because there was a massive scale-up of all these actors, we didn't have this levels of infantile malnutrition and mortality, for example. Yeah, there is really a need for a shock in the international community or in terms of international recognition in order the needs to come and not to come in coming months, to come now, like tomorrow.
Emmanuel, thank you.
Thanks to you.
Dr. Emmanuel Berbin is a food security and nutrition referent with MSF. He's in Paris. Stephen Colbert is the first to admit it was an unlikely friendship, but last night the Late Show host took a few minutes to pay tribute to his friend Toby Keith. The country music star died on Monday. He was 62. He had a lot of hits over his long career, but he became best known for unapologetically patriotic anthems, many of which he played at former President Donald Trump's pre-inaugural Make America Great Again celebration. So given their respective politics, you might have thought that Mr. Colbert and Mr. Keith would be at odds. But as Stephen Colbert acknowledged in his tribute last night, Toby Keith taught him not to prejudge a guest.
Now, I was shocked and saddened when I saw the news this morning. I knew Toby was ill, and he'd been fighting stomach cancer for some time, but I still had hope that we'd see each other again and that we would hear him on the stage. Because I was lucky enough to become friends with Toby over the years, as improbable as that seems. We met very early on the Colbert Report. And back then, there was a not-so-helpful legend that I had knives out for some of my guests, and it didn't help that at the beginning I sometimes did. And I remember having some kind of plan for Toby, I think, but right before I went on stage, I remember vividly looking down at my shoes and saying, "What are you doing? You're a host. He's your guest. Make him feel welcome. See who he is." And what do you know? We hit it off like a house of fire. I couldn't believe how much I enjoyed talking to Toby Keith. And evidently, Toby had a good time, too, because after the show, he turned and caught my eye and said, "Hey, man, you do a great job. Whatever the is you do. And I took that as the greatest compliment, so much so that my then head writer, Allison Silverman, for Christmas, had that stitched on a pillow for me. It has been in my office ever since. That day, Toby taught me not to prejudge a guest and to have my intention, but to keep my eyes open to the reality of who they are. And for that lesson and for a lot of other things, I'm always going to be grateful. This is a man who rose from Oklahoma's oil fields, where he worked on a rig, and the state's football fields, where he was a semi-professional defensive end, to become one of the most consistent hit makers in country music for more than three decades. 20 Billboard number one songs, 42 top 10 hits, and rooms full of platinum and gold albums. Toby was a great performer, unapologetically patriotic, opinionated, brash, often controversial, but resonating with legions of fans by writing their lives in a very real and entertaining way. So we had him on a lot. He was always fun. I think he enjoyed how unlikely a pair we seemed. I sure did. You know, like when people are excited when a duck and a horse are friends? Well, for the record, I was the duck. But Toby was always surprising people. You would think you know who Toby Keith was. And then you're watching Obama's Nobel acceptance speech, and there's Toby Keith giving him a standing ovation. Toby, what are you doing this time? Toby taught me not to judge people too quickly. It's something we all need to remember, because I'm sure Toby and I disagreed about many things, as so many Americans do these days. More and more of us are angrier and angrier with each other. But tonight, I will issue this invitation to anybody. I do not care who you are. I will meet you at this place. I will meet you at being brokenhearted that Toby Keith is gone.
That was Stephen Colbert paying tribute to Toby Keith on The Late Show last night. The country music star died on Monday. He was 62. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1, following The World at 6.
You can also listen to the show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.